The Tom Woods Show, episode 2147.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I am very glad to be joined today by a couple of guests who will help walk us through what on earth is going on with Bitcoin. The first of them is Stefan Lavera, who hosts one of Bitcoin's leading podcasts, the Stefan Lavera Podcast. Matter of fact, you may have seen him recently with Jeff Deist of the Mises Institute on the Human Action Podcast. He's also managing director at Swan Bitcoin International. Also joined today by Guy Swan, who hosts the Bitcoin Audible podcast and has produced an enormous amount of Bitcoin-related content. All right, let's start right here. Obviously, at least compared to the $69,000 plus peak that Bitcoin hit, right now, as we're talking, it's fluctuating between $20,000 and $22,000. Compared to the height, the all-time high, that's a slaughterhouse. Compared to when I got in, it's still an unbelievable gain for me. But let's start off, before we get into any more specific questions, what do you think is happening right now? What accounts for what's happening specifically to Bitcoin? I don't want to get into any other coins. What's happening specifically to Bitcoin? Why is this happening?
So I would just add here that we are going through this deleveraging moment for various entities in the quote-unquote crypto world. And so that's speculatively, that's part of the reason why we're seeing this. We're seeing various entities being liquidated on their leverage positions.
Let me interrupt you right there. I want this to be comprehensible to the ordinary person who doesn't know what deleveraging is, or they're too leveraged. Well, I mean, you might remember that from 2008, but you might not. So what do you mean by that?
Of course. So what we're seeing is various actors who had loan positions on, and as part of that, they can receive a margin call. And if they do not meet that margin call, their positions are sold. And so in various cases, what we've seen in the broader quote-unquote crypto space is various actors who were taking leveraged bets on the position. And if the market moves against them, they would then need to either add more collateral or be liquidated. And the word on the street, as it were, is that that's what's causing some of these recent price drops in Bitcoin, because what's happening is some of these actors in the space who have been offering yield to customers, or they have been a fund who is partaking in that, they have now come to the wrong end of the trade, let's say. And so that's one part of what we're seeing. And I think part of it is just Bitcoin just has these bull and bear cycles, and we can't fully explain all of them, just like we can't fully explain the day-to-day moves in the stock market.
Yeah, I would add, just for starters, is welcome to Bitcoin. You know, this is how Bitcoin has been since the beginning. And I think as Bitcoin becomes more and more liquid and a more stable and internet native, like the dominant monetary network on the internet, this will become less and less of a problem as time goes on. But right now, this is the price you pay for being early into the internet of money. In the broader sense, there's a lot of interest rates. The Fed's trying to raise interest rates. Like this is across the market. This is equities, stocks, everybody's retirement looks basically the same way right now. Everything is
being clobbered. Yeah, but I mean, I'm in the stock market though, and I didn't have an equivalent fall from 69,000 to 20.
Oh, well, sure. But you're looking at the difference between the amount of liquidity that the stocks and equities markets has versus Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is just going to move an exaggerated amount. You know, like stocks fall 5%, Bitcoin's probably going to fall 12%. And right now they are correlated because Bitcoin is being treated like a risk asset. So you know, when you have these deleveraging events, when you have like loans being called due, where someone has put up these assets as collateral for some sort of loan, for some sort of debt, and then they have to shore up their position because their collateral changes in price, well, they sell those assets. They sell their stocks, they put up more collateral, they sell their Bitcoin. And this is the same thing that we saw in March of 2020. That was actually the fastest drawdown in Bitcoin history. And it was essentially the same macro event happening. It went from like 6,000 to 3,000 in, I think it was like 3 days. It was a vicious dump. But it's kind of the same. I think this is kind of the same position that we're in right now. Right now, I'm a little bit dry on fiat, but this is a wonderful opportunity. I'm trying to dump everything that I don't actually need for a little bit more Bitcoin right now.
Yeah. One point I just wanted to add as well is that those people who have been just regularly stacking sats, as we say in Bitcoin, meaning purchasing small amounts every day, every week, every month. As an example, if you were stacking and you were serious about this and you started 5 years ago and you were stacking, say, $100 a week, over that time period, you would have put in about $26,000 and you would now have just under $90,000 for an ROI of about 243%. And so it's interesting that people's perception is that if they had timed it and bought everything at the top, but if you were regularly saving, I think it's quite fair to say objectively that you have done quite well.
Well, again, given when I got in, I have absolutely no complaints whatsoever. So I'm thrilled. But at the same time, I understand people who got in a little bit later getting a little bit antsy. Now, I was going to say, I have a friend who has a motto that the stock market takes the stairs up and the elevator down. Now, Bitcoin sometimes seems to take the elevator up and the elevator down. It can have wild swings.
It takes a rocket up and a stone down.
Yeah. And I think one of the consequences of that is that as you sit there, we've had a couple of cases. I mean, one recently when it hit the 69 level, but even before that, we've had cases where it really, really moved up very rapidly in a short period of time to the point where it got the attention of almost everybody. And then a lot of people got in it toward the very end because they came to the conclusion, apparently this thing just goes up infinitely. And then when it doesn't, and when it goes into severe, relatively speaking, bear territory, then people feel like they were scammed. They were led to believe Bitcoin was something other than it was. But I don't want to sound harsh, but I think they made themselves think Bitcoin was something other than it was. There is no asset that is indefinitely going to go up at that kind of rate. When it hit the 69, it had been going up and up and up and up in just a matter of a few weeks. Nothing is going to continue at that rate forever. And so I think some of the later people who came in were not thinking Bitcoin has revolutionary potential to make impressive changes in our society. It was, I'm chasing after something that looks like it can't lose. And that's not the right attitude toward anything you would do with your money.
Absolutely. And I think part of that is just the mindset. And arguably what happens is that people who are newer to Bitcoin, and part of why they're buying in at the top is because they're hearing about it. It's all over the news. Their friends are making money on it. But what happens is as that price drops, some small percentage of those people will actually do the work. They'll do the learning on why Bitcoin is special. And they become ardent supporters who then build that base for the next wave. And that's historically what we've seen in the 2013 two run-ups, the 2017 run-up, and arguably what we're seeing now.
Yeah, I think just a good way to visualize it, I think, is that, you know, the internet has essentially done nothing but grow since the 1990s, right? Like the internet has just continuously gotten bigger. This thing is a network. Bitcoin is a network protocol for ownership of an asset, of the Bitcoin asset. So it's going to continually grow as a network. But if you had invested in anything around the internet, that was not a straight line. There were absolute peaks and troughs. There was, you know, the Amazon like was massive during the 1990s. I think it was like 2011 before they actually recovered back to their dot-com bubble price. Like when something grows quickly, it almost just by its nature, by the nature of the market, it's going to get overbought on the way up and it's going to get oversold on the way down. This is the market desperately trying to find a price for something that it does not understand, that it has very vague and incomplete knowledge about, and that is growing very rapidly. So we're going to see these huge swings. And then at the exact same time, the mirror side, the flip side of the coin, is that fiat is crazy right now, that bond yields are going crazy. They're trying to squeeze interest rates up, but it's not going to work. And the debt cycles have gone from like a decade down to like a year or two. You know, basically from 2020 to here, we've kind of gone through like a whole tiny miniature debt cycle. And now I think we're going to be in a position very soon where they're going to have to try to prop it back up. Or I don't know, maybe they're going to try to save the dollar. I don't know. It's it's a mess. And Bitcoin is now it's in that environment now. So we've got basically additional factors, additional unknowns that are having a big effect on the short-term price.
Can you guys answer, it's kind of objection you hear all the time, but I would like to hear what your stock response is. You get people saying something like this, because Bitcoin is not, quote, backed by anything, it has a natural floor of zero, and that is where we are seeing it tend toward now. I would say every other person on the internet seems to be saying that exact thing. So you must have some way. I mean, obviously there's a pithy way and there's a more detailed way of responding to that, but what's your preferred answer to that?
Sure. So I would generally respond by saying, obviously you have to think about subjective value. There's beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And we also have to think about assessing Bitcoin in the right way, because a lot of people are thinking about it like a stock, like a bond, like property. We should assess Bitcoin on its monetary qualities, and we should assess it based on these characteristics, right? It's scarce. There's never going to be more than 21 million coins. You know, it's fungible. You can teleport it all around the world. These are the qualities that we should assess it based on. And so I don't like using the term intrinsic value, obviously, as we're Austrian economics influenced here. But you could think of it like people's confidence in those monetary qualities. That is actually what's backing Bitcoin, let's say, in quote-unquote word terms, to give people an easy way to think about that concept.
Yeah, I would say basically that is, I think it's misapplying a normal consumable market good for money and misunderstanding where the core value of a monetary good is. Gold is specifically a good money because when its value goes far and beyond its intrinsic value, the value that you can use it for to make jewelry or, you know, make into a metal item or something like that, when its value goes past that, when it achieves a monetary premium, it's too scarce. And because it's scarce, it's able to maintain that premium. Like, whereas if, you know, if cattle gain that premium, you just produce a lot more cattle. If TVs gained that premium, you just produce a lot more TVs until the premium disappeared. You would, quote unquote, counterfeit the excess value out of everything that isn't a monetary good. So the money, the reason a thing becomes a money is because it's able to achieve the premium of value above its intrinsic value, which makes it a tool of trust, which makes it a tool of how great are the guarantees of this as a money. That's why you've seen things in the past, like in the Kula ring, you saw like the beads and the glass beads in like a Western African coast, they were monetary goods because glass beads were incredibly hard to make for their society. When they mixed with the English could produce glass beads very quickly. And in a period of 50 years, the glass beads were essentially hyperinflated away and the entire thing collapsed. And you see the same thing with rhinestones on the islands of Yap, these giant stone discs. You couldn't do anything with them. In fact, they were specifically good money because you did nothing at all with them. They sat there. They were too big to move. But because of that, they acted as a brilliant ledger, a ledger that could not be manipulated. You could just go look at the stone and say, okay, Bob from over the top of the hill owns this stone. And then the ledger was updated by just announcing to the village that, you know, Bob now transfers this stone to Nancy. But the stone didn't do anything. The stone had no intrinsic value. It was simply a monetary guarantee because it was really hard to make. You couldn't do anything else with it. You weren't going to consume it. They're still there today. They're just covered in moss. And this monetary system worked for 500 years, again, before the Spanish came over and found out that, oh, well, we can just get a bunch of these big limestones from another island, put them on our ship, come over here, and we can use them as money. And even that got inflated away by new technology. The tool and the value of money is as a means of trust. It's trust that someone had to work to get this from you. There was no other way to fake it. There was no other way to get it. You had to produce something of value in exchange. And in the context of monetary guarantees, the promise that somebody had to do something difficult to acquire it, Bitcoin has the strongest monetary guarantees of anything on the planet right now.
Let me ask you about inflation, because people have said that Bitcoin is not doing a good job as an inflation hedge, and that some people at least had pitched it as an inflation hedge, that we've got this terrible monetary system now, we have this great alternative in Bitcoin, and Bitcoin will help you as the fiat system increasingly has problems. Well, the fiat system is having some problems, but you probably would have been better off in fiat at this particular moment in history. So was Bitcoin oversold as a hedge against inflation? Was that a misunderstanding? Or in the long run, will it be a hedge against inflation?
I'll say Bitcoin is not a good hedge against inflation on the short term. It's a great one over the long term. And in context of what you're hedging against when we're talking about like mass insolvency events and, you know, the greatest debt bubble in history, there's also a question of, are you stuck in a financial system that is permissioned, or do you own your asset? Like you say, it would have been better for a lot of people to be in dollars rather than Bitcoin during this current downturn, because, you know, the dollar inflated by like what, 8%, maybe 15% if you're taking an honest metric, whereas Bitcoin is down like 50% over that same period of time. Well, that's all relative, because if you were in Russia, you're down 100%. If you were a trucker in Canada, you're down, your assets are frozen. So you're also hedging against the permissioned infrastructure. Does the US decide whether or not you own something? Well, sure, I'm down 50% on anything I've purchased in the last, I don't know, 3-4 months, something like that, in Bitcoin. But it's also something that I still own, and I can take it to Russia with me. I can take it to Lebanon. I can take it to Argentina. I can take it to El Salvador. It doesn't really matter. It's the same thing everywhere, and I'm not beholden to a political institution. So right now, that volatility is kind of the price of being outside of the permissioned financial networks of the world.
Yeah, and I agree with Guy. I think the main point to also add is that there are 8 billion people on this earth. And let's say if we were having this conversation a few years ago, we might have even said a few billion people on earth live under high inflation regimes. And now we're getting to a stage where arguably almost the entire world is living under some kind of high inflation regime. Those who have been consistently stacking, there are various services like Swan and others out there who encourage this idea of regularly saving. And those people who have been regularly saving for the long term, talking 5 years plus, they are significantly up. And so, and I agree, this inflation hedge term can be a bit confusing, because maybe when people use that term, they're thinking of like, it should help me in the short run. But the way people like Guy and I are thinking about it, it's really more of a long-term thing that you can save into, as opposed to something that should mechanistically help you right here and now in the next month or so. That's really probably the big disconnect. And I think even for myself, I tend to shy away from that idea of the inflation hedge. And I think of it more like we're building this alternative financial system. We're building an alternative to fiat currency. It's not necessarily an inflation hedge in the short term.
And I also actually do want to add one little thing too on how to frame it, because losing 10%, or I mean, depending on whether or not you're measuring housing or CPI or whatnot, the range is pretty big, but let's just call it 10% for simplicity's sake. Losing 10% in the dollar, in the purchasing power of the dollar, is 10% that's simply gone. You got diluted for 10% of the value of your purchasing power. You'll never get that back. This is the new value of the dollar. The dollar is simply less. You have a smaller piece of the giant dollar pie because someone else is making more pie without your permission. In Bitcoin, you've experienced a temporary decline in purchasing power because of the variance in the network of Bitcoiners, in the variance in the market activity around Bitcoin, but you've not been diluted. That value can easily be recovered if you think the Bitcoin network is going to continue to grow. So I see, you know, if I see 10 years out, I think the internet is going to be bigger than it is today, which seems like an incredibly safe bet to me. And I have 1 out of 1 million shares of the internet. I'm good if the internet takes a 50% dump because Amazon goes out of business tomorrow. But if I've been inflated by doubling the amount of dollars in circulation, well, that's it. I now own half a share of the internet. And in that same context, Bitcoin is the, I have 1 out of 21 million. There's no changing that. And I think it's a very, very easy bet, at least in my opinion. Obviously, I'm deep down the freaking Bitcoin rabbit hole. But in 10 years, yeah, absolutely, it's going to be massively bigger than it is today. I have not been diluted. What I have is a discount. I have a buying opportunity in from my perspective.
I'm curious about the long-term price, the Bitcoin price in terms of US dollars. I think the consensus is that among, obviously, Bitcoin proponents, is that in the long term, this number goes way up. But I'd like to know if that's what you guys believe. And if so, can you explain to me what the fundamentals driving that would be?
So yes, I think that's fair to say. Most Bitcoin proponents believe in a longer term bullish valuation for Bitcoin, and typically that's millions of dollars per coin or higher even. But essentially, the reason why do we believe more and more people will join this network is because Bitcoin offers assurances that the fiat banking world could never offer. It's an open system. Anybody with a smartphone can set up right now with a Bitcoin wallet, and you can send it anywhere around the world. And I think there's something to that when you consider that from a global perspective, 1.7 billion people are unbanked. So there's a huge, huge market for this ability to be able to just transact in a way that you are not seeking permission. And I think it's important to step outside of the, let's say, Western world mindset that we all of us come from and understand that there are people who just don't have access to the same kinds of services that we all do. And so there's a massive, massive market of people who will really want to use this and have a reason to use this. And here's the other thing. There's not really any good alternatives for long-term savings, because if you keep your money in fiat currency, you're basically guaranteed to be devalued over time. And so it pushes all of us to think, well, how am I going to save my value? If I can save, where am I going to save? And so that answer for some people has been stocks or property or bonds, unfortunately. And, you know, 60-40 stocks and bonds got clobbered recently. And so I think that's where I see increasing adoption, because more and more people will understand the actual value and reason and what Bitcoin is different. And so I think, look, to put it in simple terms, people will understand, as they understand the problems of the fiat system, they can then understand why Bitcoin is potentially part of the answer for that.
I'll add that, I mean, basically, yes, for sure, I think the value of Bitcoin is going to go up, because when there is a absolute fixed amount of Bitcoin, and I believe the network is going to grow, the economic activity on the network, basically the only thing that can give is the price. When the supply can't change, demand goes up, price obviously has to go up. So, but I'll take a different stance on where I think we are in Bitcoin's adoption cycle by looking at it purely as a network protocol, like the internet, like TCP/IP, versus as being a money specifically, because I think the money and the unit of account, I think that will come later once liquidity is so great that Bitcoin actually becomes stable. But one thing that we're moving into right now, I feel like we're moving into kind of the second chapter of Bitcoin, where we've established it as an asset that can hold and grow value over the mid to long term. But I think we're analogous to the shift in the internet that happened right around 2000, where the back-end infrastructure of all our networks in the late 90s and early 2000s fully shifted over from analog to digital. Most users still didn't see it. Most users did not directly interface with the internet really until the mobile wave, until like 2009 came around and we had the iPhone. But during that time, the infrastructure, everything in the background moved to digital packet switching. Why? Because, and you know, go back to the 90s, what did you have? You had long distance fees. When you called all the way across the country, you were going through so many analog hubs, there was actually a hiss that was louder the longer the distance you called. But that went away. That kind of disappeared. You were still using your corded phone to make a call. You're still using an analog device, but it was going to a local hub, switching into the internet infrastructure, going digital halfway around the world, and suddenly there's no long distance fees. Suddenly the hiss is gone, because the infrastructure began to adopt the open protocol, essentially the fundamental shift in how we communicated digitally. We still have purely analog financial and monetary systems. And it might be confusing for people to think that, because they're like, oh, but I have an app. Oh, but I log into my stuff on the internet. That's just a web interface. The clear demonstration of what the result of using an analog versus a purely digital system, try to send somebody in India right now a text message versus sending them $5. Why does $5 take 3 days and cost 10% when the text message gets there instantly? That's because the financial system is purely trusted. You have one trusted, non-interoperable bank going to a higher level hierarchy permissioned bank. They all have to have giant licenses. They're all in regulatory bubbles. Then they have to go to an international settlement system. And then that one has to talk to the next regional bank. And none of these are interoperable. They have different standards. Some of them specifically, like Visa, still uses COBOL programming language. It's like 40 years old. And they actually specifically use it so that people cannot interoperate with them, so that they can maintain a monopoly. Whereas the internet is the exact opposite. Everybody's on the exact same standard. Bitcoin is entering that phase. What we're seeing right now with companies like NYDIG and Strike and these other institutions, NYDIG's partnering with like 300 banks or something right now, and Strike is partnering with NCR, which is like the biggest payments processing point of sale system in the country. I think it's like connected to between NCR and Blackhawk, which they're both partnering with. It's like 80% of like on-ground retailers or something like that. But essentially, it's creating a common standard to talk money, but it's being used to move fiat. Just like the internet was first used to connect analog phones together, it's used to move dollars. You send the equivalent amount of Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. It settles instantly. It costs like a penny or two, but your fiat suddenly loses its long distance fees. It loses the 3-day wait times because this is purely global. There's no Indian border. There's no Chinese border on Bitcoin. So as we enter kind of the network, Bitcoin, the network phase of this, the liquidity is going to grow massively because everybody's going to be buying and selling it so that they can move dollars from the United States to China and nobody waits. It happens at the exact same speed as your text message. And that's where we are, I think, in Bitcoin. We're finally in kind of the 2000s era of the internet, and everybody's going to start using Bitcoin and Lightning, but they're not going to know it. They're going to be moving dollars. That's how your app is going to get rid of its fees and get rid of its delays. And then I think that liquidity is going to continue to grow. The value of the network is going to continue to grow. And then maybe 10 years out, we'll have the quote-unquote equivalent of a mobile wave, and people will be using Bitcoin directly. But long story short, that means the Bitcoin network is going to massively grow, in my opinion. And if you've got one out of 21 million, that means the price goes up with it.
Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. Let me shift to a somewhat unrelated but very practical question that I've seen raised obviously quite a bit over the years, but really with more intensity over the past few weeks. And that is what some people insist is the importance of self-custody, that you not have your coins sitting on an exchange somewhere, but that you have your own private wallet for them. Now, can somebody, one of you, try to, again, explain this to people who may not know much about Bitcoin? What does it mean to have your coins, quote, on an exchange as opposed to self-custody? What's the difference? And maybe you can give an analogy with something that's not Bitcoin to make it easier.
Sure, yeah. So the simple way is, think of it like if you leave them with an exchange or with a custodian or a broker service, that's like an IOU. What we talk about in Bitcoin is not your keys, not your coins. And so basically, think of it like you're taking that money out and you're putting it in your own wallet, or let's say you're storing it in your own vault, let's say. And so there are easy apps that you can use to do this, like Moon Wallet, M-U-U-N. So muun.com is a phone wallet that you can use just to get started, and you can withdraw from the exchange, or you can get a hardware wallet. So common ones like the Cold Card or Trezor or Ledger, these are common ones. But in the background, what's really going on, think of it like your Bitcoin wallet is generating a special key, and it is able to then sign a message to say, yes, I have the special key to move these coins. And so that's what we're talking about when we're saying private keys. Now, of course, these wallets and software, they're abstracted away. All the difficult stuff is in the background. But just so people get a conceptual awareness, the point is that you don't want to be reliant on these custodians. And people got a real reality check recently with Celsius recently stopping withdrawals. And I think that was about 3 or 4 days ago as we speak. And so this is a very real reality check, because now they haven't reopened withdrawals, and there are customers who are sitting and waiting and thinking, oh, am I going to have to sue them now to try and get my coins back? Am I, you know, how long is this going to take? And of course, for those people who are familiar with the early history, the famous example here is Mt. Gox in 2013, which when that went down, you know, it's been years and years and years before people were able to get their coins back. And basically, many of them still have not. So
I was about to say, I don't think anybody's really gotten their coins back. the not your keys, not your coins is something that is a hard-earned rule of Bitcoin for anybody who's been in the space for any length of time. The easiest way to think about it is whether or not you hold your cash like in your physical hand or you hold cash in a bank. Well, that bank can just not give it to you, or that bank can be insolvent and you find out your cash was not there in the first place. The difference between using your key directly, your key is just your ownership. It's essentially a password that says you own Bitcoin. As long as you don't share that password, you're the only one who can unlock it. And you can either talk directly to Bitcoin. Like, Bitcoin is its own network. It's its own entity on the internet and nobody owns it. Nobody controls it. It's just out there. So you can either talk directly to Bitcoin. That's you holding your own keys and you managing your own funds. Or you can talk to an exchange that talks to the Bitcoin network for you. And when you do that, you're completely beholden to the exchange. The exchange can lie and say you own Bitcoin and you don't even know, or the exchange can just say you have honked too much in this particular area of Canada and thus you cannot get your Bitcoin back. All your Bitcoins now belong to us. Maybe a fun analogy to think about it is that it's a purely permissioned system. So like from the context of an exchange, you're in a purely permissioned relationship. So like if imagine your house is completely impenetrable, and the only way you can get in is unlock it with your key. If you keep your key safe, nobody is ever going to get into your house. They could drop a nuclear bomb on it and your house is fine. You have your key, you can get into it. If you lose your key, well, you can't get into your house either. The house is virtually deleted because nobody, you can't even get in with a nuclear bomb, right? Now imagine that you install a digital Amazon lock on your front door and they validate that it's you to get into your house. Well, if Amazon decides with that lock instead of your actual key, if they decide that you don't own the house because, again, you honked too loud or whatever, well, then the house is not yours and there's nothing you can do about it. Amazon has pure and total control over your house. That is using Bitcoin on an exchange. Maybe you trust Amazon. I don't. So I'm going to have my own key.
But there must be some... If it's that obvious, then it seems like everybody would do it that way. There must be some convenience associated with having your coins on exchange.
Right.
Is it that it's just easier.
Risk is just... But the risk outweighs the convenience. Is that your point?
Yeah, because you think about it, like you can rehypothecate dollars and create new loans and debts and they're going to get bailed out. You've got FDIC insurance. You've got all these sorts of fail safes because you have an unsound money. You have money that people can print, that we can just loan into existence. So there's always a failsafe. There's always a lender of last resort, right? Bitcoin doesn't have that. If they screw it up, your Bitcoin are just gone. Bitcoin doesn't have a corporation that you can call to say, undo this transaction. Like if the exchange screws it up, there's no bailout. There's no rehypothecation. There's no new loan. There's no Federal Reserve. It's just gone. So the risk is much higher if you do not own your Bitcoin.
Yeah, and I'll just add to what Guy was saying there, I think, and to what you were saying, Tom, part of the reason why a lot of people were not self-custodying is because they were chasing yield. They were using platforms like Celsius and others where they were getting what they thought was this relatively risk-free return on their coins, or even in the case of the Luna UST Ponzi, where they had this anchor protocol and it was promising 20% returns. So you can see why there are reasons why certain providers or certain websites would offer this kind of thing and say, hey, look, you're getting very bad interest rates with your bank. Why don't you keep your money with us and we'll pay you this interest? And that was also part of why a lot of them were not self-custodying. And this is a hard lesson that many people are having to learn. And I think many of us in the Bitcoin space were really trying to educate people and say, no, look, you got to understand there's a lot of risk when you leave your coins with a custodian. And this is why it's a perennial rule of the space. It's not your keys, not your coins. And yes, there will be some element to which it's less convenient, but at the same time, it protects you, it protects your coins, and arguably it helps protect the system because there's less potential for fractional reserving, especially in Bitcoin's no bailout environment. In Bitcoin, there are no bailouts.
Do you guys, each of you, have a 60-second or so elevator pitch that if you had the opportunity to run a 60-second ad that would be viewed across the world in which you could say anything you wanted to the world about Bitcoin? Do you have anything like that in mind? What would it be? What would it sound like?
So the money you keep in your bank account is devaluing rapidly over time. And you don't have an easy way to save. Bitcoin is the way to save because it is scarce and it can be teleported anywhere around the world instantly, just like you would send an email. And so for this reason, it's worth your while to research into why your fiat money system is broken and why Bitcoin is an answer to this problem, because it solves things that the fiat banking system and the fiat world and fiat currency will never solve for you.
Not bad. Guy, do you want to take a crack at it?
I would say all of the money of the world today is political. We are subject to whatever it is they deem appropriate for us. They manipulate how we allocate it. They manipulate how we spend it. And sure, someone can argue that, oh, well, we can vote to have the government protect us and we can have the vote to have the government bail us out. What you end up in is a nice soft cage. And Bitcoin is a political money. It is money. It is a new money under an entirely new system in the digital age. With that comes volatility because it is freedom money. It is money that is truly free that you own with or without anybody's permission. The president of the United States can write whatever he wants down on a piece of paper and it doesn't matter. If you have your keys, you have your Bitcoin. Freedom comes with volatility. Freedom comes with responsibility. You don't seek freedom because it's safe and it's easy. You seek it because it's freedom. And the cost of that is taking responsibility for it. Sure, it's volatile. Sure, it's going to be a wild ride to get there. But I think removing money from the state in any and every way that we can is the most important thing we can do right now. All the biggest problems in the world are because the government has an unlimited tool to just confiscate and reroute all of our goods and services, everything that we try to build and everything that we try to make, and we need to remove that from them. And I think Bitcoin is the answer to that, honestly.
If people want to follow each of you guys, Stefan, you want to go first? What's the easiest way to do that?
Sure. So people who want to keep up with where I'm working, I work at swan.com. That's an easy place for people to learn and buy Bitcoin. If they want to find me and my podcast, that's stefanlevera.com. Thanks again for having me, Tom. I'm a big fan.
I appreciate that. And it's S-T-E-P-H-A-N.
That's right.
Levera.com. Yes. Okay, Guy.
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at TheGuySwan. And that's Swan with two N's. No relation to Swan, even though I love the crew over there. and we've worked together for a long time. I host the Bitcoin Audible podcast, as well as the Shitcoin Insider. But that one's much more infrequent. It's just kind of my little guilty pleasure of picking on crypto stuff. I think Bitcoin has a rather incredible future. If you want to learn or explore literally any topic about it, that is literally what the show does. That's Bitcoin Audible. We read the philosophy, the economics, and everything. And Tom, also, I just wanted to say, you were kind of my entry point probably 10 years ago, 11 years ago, down the Austrian economics rabbit hole. You were kind of like that totem, that foundation for navigating me through all of that. I would say I'm trying to work off your example to try to be that for a few people in Bitcoin. And just a huge thanks, man. I've been a fan for a really long time.
Well, my thanks to you for that kind remark. I appreciate that very much. Well, thanks to both of you. I'll have the links to the stuff you guys do up at tomwoods.com/2147. Thank you. And you know, by the way, I very often when I have people on to talk about Bitcoin, it's happening at a time when there's some big crash or something and people are demanding answers, you know? So it's like, I always think of it this way. It's like when you see, there are certain relatives you see only at funerals and you always say, I'm so sorry we have to see each other under these circumstances. Well, that's sort of how I feel about today. But I felt like people who listen to this program wanted to know what on earth is happening. And I wanted to bring on a couple of people who could shed some light on that. And I think we've done that. So thanks again.
Cool, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for another week. Now, if you like and appreciate what goes on around here, if you feel like you're getting value from this day in and day out, then head over to supportinglisteners.com and wait till you see all the goodies I have in store for you. You know, maybe you hear me say that and you think, I don't know, maybe there's a goodie or two. You know, maybe there's three goodies. You have no idea the entire list of goodies And the more you support, the more goodies you get. You know, it's a very, very simple relationship. So check it out over at supportinglisteners.com. That is where the cream of the crop are to be found. These are the people who belong to the Tom Woods Show Elite, which is my private censorship-free group. But also, there are many other benefits you get being a supporter of the Tom Woods Show, not just membership in that group. There's so many benefits. It is shocking. So go check that out, supportinglisteners.com, over the weekend, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.